Hello again, everyone, wherever you may be, and welcome to another edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week, your window on the world of Iowa politics, where we explore and analyze who's been making news in and around the state capital, what that news is, and what it all means. I'm Dennis Hart, joined as always by my partner in politics, Laura Bellin of the blog site Bleeding Heartland. Welcome, Laura.
Good to be here, Dennis.
Laura, after being together in studio in Ames last week, and that was delightful, we are both back at different remote sites again tonight. I will reveal I am in Spokane, Washington, in a hotel room tonight, making the trek west. I won't reveal where you are because that's a secret, but we're back to our usual half-hour format, and we are packing a lot into it. Are you ready to get started?
I am ready.
All right, Capital Week Caucus Almanac. Briefly off the top, trial date has been set for former President Donald Trump.
Well, it looks like it may already be postponed because the initial trial date was set for August 14th, but I just saw that a few days ago, the special counsel Jack Smith has requested a delay until December. That's one of the main reasons for the delay is that the former president does not have defense attorneys right now who have the required security clearance that they are going to need to do this trial. So I would say Jack Smith has said he wants a speedy trial, but I'll be surprised if anything happens before December.
I would be surprised if anything happened before the November election. Wouldn't you think that the former president wants to delay this?
I think so. And I mean, there may be ways that he can delay it, but a December trial date, I mean, that would happen probably just weeks before the Iowa caucuses at a time, and it could be a 2-week trial. So I'm sure that he won't want to be stuck in a courtroom in South Florida when all the other candidates are going to be campaigning in Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina.
As if we didn't have enough Republican presidential candidates already. Well, another one jumped into the field last week, the 14th GOP candidate, and this one is from Texas.
Yes, the former U.S. Representative Will Hurd. I don't know how much we're going to hear from him because he has already said that he's not going to sign any kind of loyalty pledge. The Republican National Committee has said that to qualify for the debates, the primary debates, you're going to have to promise to support the eventual nominee. And he's said right out of the gate that he is not going to be supporting Donald Trump again. I will say that he did vote against both of the impeachments of Trump. So he has been, although he's critical of the president now, he didn't take the action that he could have taken to make Trump ineligible as a candidate for office.
Mr. Hurd is what we might call a long shot presidential candidate. In fact, of the 14 GOP candidates, I believe 12 of them are considered long shots.
Yes. Very much. And I mean, he's competing for the same niche, I would say, as former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie and Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson. They're all competing for this critical of Donald Trump, not willing to kowtow to Donald Trump niche, whereas most of the other candidates are trying to make a case for themselves without offending people who still support Trump.
Meanwhile, some current presidential candidates, the ones already who had announced for the Republicans, came to Iowa last week. One of them, former Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson.
Yes, and he is still doing events in Iowa. He's not drawing large crowds, but he seems to be committed to covering a large part of the state. I mean, I think it's going to be really difficult for him. One thing that I'm not sure we've talked about is that when he was governor of Arkansas, he vetoed a ban on gender-affirming care for minors. It ended up passing, the legislature passed it, overriding his veto. And now he has said that he thinks that abortion should be an issue for the states to regulate, but he would support a 15-week national ban. Well, 15 weeks is not something that is going to satisfy the Republican primary or caucus electorate.
We're going to talk more about abortion in just a moment or two, but first, another candidate came in, another Republican candidate, one of my favorite long, 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 long shots, Ryan Binkley. Let me repeat that name for you, Ryan Binkley.
Well, I love the Des Moines Register coverage of his latest visit because it mentioned that he was at a brewery in Des Moines and that he told an audience of about 15 people that he wants to inspire a national culture shift for a generation, which is pretty difficult to inspire a national culture shift when you're speaking to crowds of fewer than 2 dozen people. And I think that one problem that candidates like Ryan Binkley have is just getting the message out is going to be very difficult. I mean, he's a pastor, he's talked talked in religious terms, but lots of candidates are competing for that niche, have been going to meet with influential Iowa pastors, have been talking very openly about their faith and their stump speech. So it's just hard to see where Ryan Binkley is going to be able to get any traction.
But just remember, Laura, 15 people at a brewery can often sound like 16 or 17 people at a brewery.
It could. It could.
Now, this is another one. This is an interesting one, and this is going to have an impact potentially on the race all through November. Hunter Biden, the president's son, who has been in trouble off and on. He's a troubled young man or a middle-aged man. He pleaded guilty in a tax and gun case last week. This is not the last we're going to hear of this because the Republicans are going to make hay, but he is prepared to enter a plea.
Yes, and I have been following a lot of defense attorneys on Twitter and looking at the commentary on this. It's basically a non-payment of taxes from 2017 and 2018. The gun charge is related to the fact that when he purchased a gun, he said that he didn't use drugs, and at the time, he was a regular user of illegal drugs. And one of the defense attorneys was saying that this is actually rare. I saw a lot of Republican criticism that Hunter Biden was getting a great deal, a sweet deal, a plea agreement. In fact, it's pretty rare for people to go to prison over a tax violation like this. In fact, sometimes the people don't even get probation. They just pay their back taxes and pay some kind of a fine and resolve the case that way. So the firearms purchase, you know, again, it will be something, as you say, that Republicans are going to talk about. I must confess, Dennis, a few days ago, I was on a different radio show on a different station. In a different market, but there was a Republican speaking in the same panel that I was on, and he was basically saying that the president is a dictator, that he's trying to jail his political opponent in Donald Trump while getting a sweet deal for his son. And this is the kind of rhetoric that I think is going to be very common in Republican circles.
So what kind of impact might this have on Joe Biden's re-election campaign nationally? Here in Iowa, there's no question Joe doesn't have a lot of a chance there. But how might this impact the national race?
I think this is going to be old news by a year and 5 months from now. I mean, I also think that Hunter Biden, I mean, I know that it's something that a lot of Republicans have talked about, but I haven't seen any evidence in the polling that this is an angle that really hurts Joe Biden. The fact is that a lot of Americans have somebody in their family or somebody they care about who struggled with addiction. And Hunter Biden didn't own the gun for a long time. He didn't use the gun to commit a crime. He didn't commit a violent crime. And so I just don't know that this is going to be something that will significantly affect the next election.
Laura admitting tonight that she was on another radio station and I'm in a hotel room in Spokane, Washington on this Monday night. What does this all mean? Oh, boy. All right. Last week, Laura, when we were together at KHOI in studio in Ames, Iowa, we talked a lot about abortion and we're going to spend some time on it right now. You thought that perhaps, well, we didn't think it was over, that this whole thing was just starting after the state Supreme Court essentially kept a ban on the fetal heartbeat law so that abortion remains legal 20 weeks in Iowa. Nothing has changed on that in the last week, but everybody's been agitating and getting together. Let's start with Iowa Planned Parenthood. This is interesting. They're going to close some of their Iowa locations to expand their services. How is this going to work?
Yes, and this has been a long-term trend with Planned Parenthood. I mean, if you think about 20 to 30 years ago, Planned Parenthood operated quite a lot more clinics around the state. They weren't all open 5 days a week, but they had a lot of clinics in smaller communities. And over time, there's been consolidation in Planned Parenthood, like you've seen in other aspects of healthcare. And this is something that the organization was saying last week, that they've seen increased demand because since the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in last year's Dobbs decision, there are more people traveling from states that have banned abortion to states like Iowa. And meanwhile, they have staffing issues. They have the same kind of staffing issues at their clinics that we see across the healthcare industry. So they're going to close close a Southside Des Moines location, an Omaha location, and one in Cedar Falls. And then they're going to expand services in a different Des Moines clinic, which is in the Drake University neighborhood, also in Ames and in Cedar Rapids, which is, I think, a little less than an hour's drive from Cedar Falls. So they were saying that they're going to, and the patients that would have gone to the Council Bluffs Clinic are going to be going across the river to a Planned Parenthood facility in Omaha. So they're saying that they expect that probably they will be performing more abortions. The majority of abortions now in Iowa are medication abortions rather than surgical, but the demand for services is increasing because of what's going on in other states.
Yeah, one of the interesting sidelines is they said last week the number of patients traveling from other regions has risen 100%, as a lot of states have, unlike Iowa, severely limited abortions.
Yes, I mean, it happened very quickly after the Dobbs decision came down last summer.
All right. There was more agitation last week on both sides. Anti-abortion advocates rallied at the state capitol on Saturday, about 100 of them calling on state lawmakers to do more to restrict abortion.
Yes, and we talked about this last week, that I don't expect that the Republican majorities are going to wait until next year's legislative session begins in January to deal with abortion. For one thing, that's an election year. I think they'd prefer to get this out of the way before the election year. And also, the sooner they pass another law and the governor signs it into effect, the sooner there will be a lawsuit that will start working its way through the courts. And they haven't given up hope that the Iowa Supreme Court would eventually uphold an abortion ban that is very similar to the 2018 law that did not go into effect. That decision that we talked about for so long last week, I mean, it was a non-decision really because the court split 3-3, but it doesn't mean that the Iowa Supreme Court wouldn't necessarily uphold a new law that didn't have all of the complicated procedural issues that came up in that lawsuit.
And meanwhile, aside from the Capitol rally, a panel of anti-abortion advocates meeting in Iowa sent a message to GOP presidential hopefuls who are going to be campaigning here. Among those was Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, who was there, and he said he's proposed legislation to ban abortion starting at 15 weeks of pregnancy. I don't think that's flying in Iowa. That's too much. But he called it a critical moment for the Republican Party.
Yes, and I've seen somebody who used to work on Lindsey Graham's staff and is a national Republican strategist. He's been trying to rally conservatives behind this national ban at 15 weeks, and that's just something that's not going to make anybody happy. I mean, the Republican lawmakers, there are some Republican legislators in Iowa who I think might go for something closer to 12 weeks, but really for a large number of them, even 6 weeks is as lenient as they will go. And I think that that's also the case for several of the presidential candidates. But Donald Trump himself actually has hesitated to talk about banning abortion nationally. So I think this is going to be a tricky issue for them to navigate. But it's clear that to get Bob Vanderplaats's endorsement before the caucuses, somebody is going to have to call for a nationwide abortion ban.
And Iowa Democrats talked to the press last week, and they said they expect the governor call a special legislative session soon. We all of us do, I think, in the news media. Where do you see this going? Now, you've written about this, and we talked about it a bit last week. You think Republicans, who have these vast majorities in both houses, might have trouble getting together on exactly what a new abortion law should look like?
Yes, and the recent Des Moines Register reporting basically validated what we were talking about last week, that within the Republican caucuses in the Iowa House and Senate, there are people who want more exceptions, stronger exceptions than what was in the 2018 law. And then there are people who would prefer to have a total ban with no exceptions other than the life of the mother and not even going up to 6 weeks. But of course, there are a lot of people who wouldn't vote for a total abortion ban. So I think everybody would prefer to get this out of the way before January, but they're not going to call a special legislative session unless they have language that everybody can get behind, because the last thing they want is to come to Des Moines and then spend days or weeks grinding through and calling attention to this issue. The latest polling that we have of Iowans, which is by Ann Seltzer for the Des Moines Register and Mediacom in March, showed that 61% of Iowa adults think abortion should be mostly legal or always legal. And whatever they're talking about passing is going to certainly be mostly illegal or almost always illegal. I mean, the 6-week ban is estimated to eliminate probably about 98% of abortions. So I think that the Republicans, it is going to be a little bit tricky. The governor has not said for sure. I do think she intends to call a special legislative session, but you'll notice that she hasn't committed publicly to doing that. And I think that's because they're waiting to make sure everybody can get on the same page first.
We will be on this case throughout the year, and just stay with us on these Monday nights and on our replays. We'll be talking about abortion, and we'll have the very latest for you as it takes place. Meanwhile, Let me quickly insert that it's 14 after the hour, wherever you are in the world. And this is KHY's Capital Week with Laura Bellin, otherwise known as Keyboard Warrior Laura Bellin, and me, Dennis Hart, otherwise known as your trained broadcast specialist, Dennis Hart. And this is KHY's Capital Week, your one-stop source for everything political going on in Iowa. We are here every week at this time to talk about what's been happening in and around the state capitol and what it all means. And now that we have new titles, Laura, we're even more energized to have the second half of the show. Are you ready?
I am ready.
All right. Joni Ernst, U.S. Senator from Iowa, of course, spoke out in opposition last week to a proposed rule change. It's a little complicated rule change, but it would essentially prohibit full bans on transgender students from taking part. She's opposed to a rule change involving Title IX that would prohibit full bans on transgender students from taking part on sports teams. Okay, so she speaks in opposition to this. Governor Reynolds signed legislation last year about this very thing. Where do we go from here?
Okay, so first, I just want to give the big picture here. And Joni Ernst is the fourth most senior person in the U.S. Senate for the Republican Party. She is responsible for a lot of the communication, and she's often out there talking about women's issues. Republicans are very aware that they have a problem with women voters right now, largely because of what's going on in the abortion rights front. And so elevating this issue of transgender athletes, I think that that's part of a strategy to try to bring women back toward the Republican Party. This is not something that Joni Ernst ever campaigned on, really, or talked about during her first term, but it's something that she's talking about with increased frequency now. So that's the overall picture. The rule change that the Biden administration put out there, they were trying to strike a middle ground. I think within the LGBTQ advocacy community, people are mixed on this. The idea is that they don't want to allow, the federal government doesn't want to allow all-out bans on transgender participation in girls' sports teams, but they want to have a middle ground that allows for some regulation. For instance, perhaps at the varsity high school level, that there could be some kind of restrictions. By the way, I have been unable to find any examples of transgender girls playing varsity sports in Iowa, I mean, in any sport or qualifying for the state tournament or anything like that. I really looked into that last year when the legislature passed that law. So we're talking about a small number of people who would be affected. But of course, Iowa is one of the states that has passed a total ban, which under this Title IX proposed regulation change, that would run afoul of the federal regulation. So, I mean, that's why the Senator Ernst has been speaking out about it. But I think that it's just something that we're generally going to hear Republican candidates talking about for the next year and a half.
And as we reported before, and this involves gender-affirming care, Iowa passed a law, the governor signed it into law, banning gender-affirming care for minors. Now, you reported on Bleeding Heartland that federal judges in four states have blocked the governments there from enforcing such bans. So what does that have to do, perhaps, how will that affect Iowa?
Well, a lot of people have asked me, why hasn't somebody filed a lawsuit over Iowa's law? Remember, the governor signed it into law in March. And I think that one big reason is that prospective plaintiffs were waiting for this blockbuster court decision that came out of a U.S. district court in Arkansas last week. Arkansas, as I mentioned earlier, was the first state to pass a ban on gender-affirming care for minors. They passed that over the veto of the then governor, Asa Hutchinson. And so the litigation began in Arkansas first. So this was the first time they had a full trial last year. It was an eight-day trial where lots of witnesses were called, lots of exhibits were entered. And last Tuesday, the judge in that case issued a decision which had about 60 pages of factual findings and then many findings of constitutional law. And the upshot is that he permanently blocked Arkansas from enforcing that law. He said that it's a violation of equal protection for transgender youth. It's a violation of parental rights because parents should have the right to make medical decisions for their children. And it's a First Amendment free speech violation because it restricts doctors from referring patients and their families to care elsewhere. And so that I'm sure now the governor, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, has already said she's going to appeal that up to the Eighth Circuit. But in any case, I mean, that is going to be important. The findings of fact are going to be important. And as you mentioned, three other states, Alabama, Indiana, and now Florida, have had preliminary injunctions in place on their laws. So they can't enforce their laws while litigation proceeds. And I expect that the same thing is going to happen, that within the next few months, probably a lawsuit will be filed in Iowa. And that will result in Iowa's law being having a preliminary injunction that prevents the state from enforcing it.
All right, let's talk briefly about ethanol. Everybody has to use it. Many people use it anyway, and gas. A couple of things last week. The EPA limited, scaled back how much ethanol should be blended into the nation's gas supply over the next 2 years. That enraged everybody in Iowa, all decision makers. But this afternoon on Monday, U.S. Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack announced Iowa convenience store operators are going to receive more than $2.5 million in federal money to help expand consumer access to higher blends of renewable fuels. So ethanol, back and forth, it always goes back and forth.
And we had talked about this last year because you'll recall the Iowa legislature last year passed a bipartisan bill that was going to incentivize the sales of these higher ethanol blends. And one issue is that a lot of gas stations don't even have the capacity to sell those higher blends. And so that's where this federal funding comes in. I mean, it's pretty expensive for a small gas station that doesn't do a high volume of sales to retrofit all their equipment. So Tom Vilsack, always been a big supporter of biofuels. But yes, as you said, the Iowa congressional delegation. They were very harsh about the EPA. They're not big fans of the EPA in the Biden administration anyway. And the evidence, I mean, the reality is that the evidence of ethanol's benefits for climate change is very mixed. I mean, in some ways, there have been studies that show if you take into account the production and the growth of corn, that in fact it may even increase greenhouse gas emissions. But in any case, the Biden administration and Iowa politicians of both parties are very committed to keeping the biofuels industry going for as long as they can.
Just want everybody to know, as we're driving across country from east to west here, I am putting in E10 in every gas pump I'm finding. By the way, the highest priced gas that we found so far this afternoon in Washington State, $4.66 a gallon.
Yeah, it's usually higher on the West Coast than it is around here.
I know this is even higher than in California. All right, State Department of Education director resigned last week, Chad Aldis. Now, that happens. People resign. What makes this interesting is that he was only on the job for 4 months. What happened here?
Well, I don't think anybody really knows what happened. If Guy sent a question to the governor's office, you know what, how long has this been in the works? Because he was just appointed in March. They just announced his resignation and the governor has already hired somebody from Virginia. So there must have been a search ongoing for at least several weeks to find this person. So you just wonder whether they almost started searching for his successor as soon as he was on the job. And when the Iowa Senate was debating his confirmation, I heard some speculation that maybe this is just a placeholder and the governor really is looking for somebody else. And so I don't know exactly what happened, but that, I mean, the press release said that Chad Aldis was stepping down for unspecified family reasons, but it is pretty irregular for somebody to be replaced only a few months after taking office. The other thing that's unusual about both Chad Aldis and Mackenzie Snow, who's now going to be coming from the deputy director position in Virginia, the Department of Education, to lead Iowa's department, is that neither of them have any professional experience working in public schools. And that's different for Iowa. I mean, past governors of both parties have typically picked somebody with extensive public school experience, perhaps a former superintendent, former principal, or somebody who was in the classroom for many years. And that's experience that neither Mackenzie Snow nor Chad Aldis has.
All right, let's talk about a couple of legal cases. The first one, the state Supreme Court last week said the ex-health spokesperson, Polly Carver Kim, who we've talked about many times, can sue the state for wrongful termination, but not Governor Reynolds. How did this play out?
Well, this is one of those cases where I think the significance of it goes far beyond Polly Carver Kim's case. Now, the upshot is that she can proceed with both of her wrongful termination claims against the state. She was forced to resign in July of 2020, a few months into the pandemic, and she asserts that she was fired, basically forced out, because she was trying to comply with the open records law. Now, the fact that the governor and the governor's former spokesperson, Pat Garrett, were dismissed as defendants, the attorneys I talked to on Friday said that's really of little consequence. I mean, she can still proceed with claims against the state. But the more important thing is that by a 4-3 majority, the Iowa Supreme Court said that the open records law is the kind of public policy that can support this kind of a claim. And that means that other people who are charged with either working at the state level or for county or city governments, and their job is providing public records, now they have an additional measure of protection. If their boss says, you better not release that information or you're going to be fired, now they know that they have a wrongful termination claim for that kind of a situation. So we don't know whether she'll be successful. This is going to go back to the lower court for trial, which probably won't happen for maybe a year and a half. And she may or may not succeed in proving her claims in court. But this Iowa Supreme Court decision was very important for people who handle public records requests for Iowa government agencies.
All right, we have about 4 minutes left, and we need to talk about this particular case because it involves somebody on this broadcast. It was reported last week, widely reported, that Governor Reynolds is settling three lawsuits from journalists and others seeking public records after losing a key state Supreme Court case this year. The governor agreed to pay an amount of money after being sued by Clark Kaufman of Iowa Capital Dispatch and Laura Bellin of Bleeding Heartland and others for failing to respond to requests for documents during the early stages of the coronavirus pandemic. All right, Laura, you are involved in this. Tell us what's happening here, what happened, and what this all means.
Well, as of today, the settlement agreement is final. It was approved by a Polk County judge. And so this is going forward. So in April, the Iowa Supreme Court resolved a key argument in this case. The governor's office was trying to have the lawsuit dismissed. We had sued in December of 2021 because we had many outstanding public records requests. Some of mine went back for about a year and a half or longer. And then shortly after we filed the suit, the governor's office provided many of the records, and then they sought to have our case dismissed as moot because they had provided the records. So the Iowa Supreme Court said that an excessive delay can constitute a violation of the open records law. So we are allowed to go back to lower court to proceed with our claims that the governor's office violated the law. So at that stage, the state agreed to settle the case. They are going to pay $135,000. That's all going for attorney's fees for the ACLU of Iowa, who represented us in the case. We didn't ask for any monetary damages for any of the plaintiffs. And it means that there is also, the governor's office has promised to comply with the open records law going forward, and that is going to be judicially enforced for the next year. So it means that if there are any issues at any time during the next year, we could theoretically go to court to say that the governor's office is not abiding by the settlement agreement. But the governor's office did not admit any violation of the law. And that was one reason that last week, when the Iowa Appeals Board considered this settlement, the state auditor, Rob Sand, voted against it. The state appeal board approved the settlement with the votes of state treasurer, Robbie Smith, and the state budget director, Craig Paulson. But Rob Sand said that he didn't think that taxpayers should be on the hook for this. And he also thought that the governor's office should be forced to admit that they broke the law.
All right. So we have a couple of minutes left. Can you explain, I know you can, why this is important to Joe Public in Iowa? Why was your lawsuit important?
Well, it means that in the future, anybody, and by the way, the open records law applies to anybody. Journalists don't have any kind of special privileges under that law. But it means that if you file a public records request, the government body can't just ignore it forever until you sue and then say, oh, I'm going to give you the records now and dismiss your lawsuit. They can't just stonewall you endlessly. That's a violation of the law. The governor's office was trying to claim that since they never explicitly refused, like they never sent an email saying, we won't give you the records, they were saying that they never refused to give us the records. And the Iowa Supreme Court said, no, an excessive delay is tantamount to refusing to provide records. And so that's very important for average people. And I know lots of people who have run into the situation, and not just with state agencies, but maybe they asked for records from their city government or from their county government, and they don't hear anything back for months. Well, this gives them some kind of recourse under this Iowa Supreme Court precedent that you can't just ignore somebody's public records request. They really are obligated to respond to those records requests as promptly as is feasible for them.
All right. 30 seconds. Do this one very quickly. Two Northwest Iowa school districts that have voted last year to arm staff members, guns, rescinded those policies in order to prevent being dropped by their insurance carrier. That was a wild development last week.
Yes, the Spirit Lakes was the first school district, followed by Cherokee, also up in Northwest Iowa. And their insurance agent told them, your liability policy is going to be dropped. He sought out 26 different companies. He couldn't find anybody willing to underwrite the school district. And I expect we'll be hearing about this during next week's legislative session. The Republican majority, certainly one of the members of the House leadership, has said they're going to try to pass a law that will require insurance companies to underwrite school districts that have these kinds of policies. But for now, they're revoked.
All right, Laura, that's it. We're only a half an hour tonight. I will see you next week, not from this hotel room in Spokane, Washington.
Well, I'll still be here from the home base in Windsor Heights.
There you go. We've revealed it. She's in Windsor Heights. That's it. We're out of time for this edition of Capital Week. A reminder that the views and opinions expressed here did not necessarily reflect the opinions of KHOI or its staff. Laura and I will be back next week in the very same time slot, though not me in the same location, somewhere else, when we'll talk about everything interesting, important, or entertaining about politics Iowa style. As always, we hope you can join us. Until then, we hope you have a safe, healthy, and very, very happy week.